going to go on to case number 2, and that is appeal number 062148. Esteban Montano et al. Versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Cerda, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm going to begin with parts 3 and 4 of plaintiff's argument. Part 3 has to do with the ruling on the Rule 50 motion. The defendants have acknowledged on appeal that the court erred in granting the defendant's Rule 50 motion with respect to all but two of the plaintiff's claims, and they have to do with Officer LaFrancis pulling Esteban Montano's hair. And with regard to that claim, defendants assert that plaintiff did not provide a pin site in their appellate brief to the hair pulling.
Now, of course,
but
that argument, your argument, will come to nothing if Judge Duryigian was within his discretion to dismiss the case as a sanction for perjury and misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm moving quickly on to that point. Because it's significant that the defendants acknowledge that that there were triable issues of fact that were improperly dismissed at trial. With regard to I'll move on to the sanctions issue. With regard to the sanction issue, it's quite a unique case. The case was tried before visiting Judge O'Meara. 3 years later, the case was assigned to Judge Duryigian. Defendants then submitted motions for sanctions regarding conduct at the trial presided over by Judge O'Meara. We submit, first, with regard to standards, this is a very unusual case ordinarily a trial court would have discretion to impose sanctions because the trial judge is in a unique position to observe the conduct.
You see, after granting the defendant's motion for judgment as a matter of law on some claims and declaring a mistrial on the remaining claims, visiting Judge O'Meara said he would consider giving notice and an order to show cause on the Rule 11CB sanctions. I did not see in the docket any order to show cause or follow up on imposing sanctions. Have I missed something?
No, Your Honor, there is no order. In fact, with regard to the sanctions issue, that's a two-part argument made by the city, that there was improper conduct on my part and there was perjury on the part of four of the five plaintiffs. With regard to me, Judge O'Meara said at the conclusion of the trial that I should not be faulted for anything I did other than have, that I was nothing but a zealous advocate for my client. The purported misconduct on my part was, well, if I may go back to the standard, Your Honor, with regard to this unique case, ordinarily there's abuse of discretion given to the trial court because the trial court is in a unique position.
Yeah, but you know, of course, that in this case, our court, Rule 36'd this.
Yes.
Our court said this case needs a different judge.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's, pretty unusual.
And I think in part, Your Honor, because this court recognized that perhaps Judge O'Meara was biased. He believed that plaintiffs created or manufactured this incident after seeing the Rodney King videotape. What happened to Rodney King? They thought they'd create this incident.
You know, what the Court of Appeals thought is not something that's on the record or something that, we can wonder about. All we know is that the Court of Appeals did not wish visiting Judge O'Meara to continue with this case.
Yes, Your Honor. Just with regard, we may not have to cross the bridge because I think that there were no grounds for sanctions in the case. But we would submit that this in this unusual circumstances, there should be clear and convincing evidence and no deference should be given to Judge Daryagin's opinion because he was not in the position of the trier of fact. With regard to the sanctions issue, the defendant submitted that I engaged in instances of improper conduct which merited the dismissal of the entire case. That, for example, I improperly questioned defendant Meduzia. Defendant Meduzia was a lockup keeper. At his and he was accused of ordering the male plaintiffs to strip search, to strip to be searched. At his deposition, I asked Officer Meduzia, well, what's the definition of strip search? And he more or less said, well, you know, the city has its definition, but, you know, causing someone to disrobe and expose their genitalia was not a strip search. I concluded my direct examination of Meduzia at his deposition. His attorney, instead of questioning him at that time, asked for a break. Officer Meduzia and his attorney came back. The first question asked of Meduzia, well, you know, what's the definition of a strip search? And Officer Meduzia changed his testimony. At trial, I asked Officer Meduzia about his definition of a strip search, and he gave the correct definition of a strip search. And I said, well, that wasn't your answer at trial. And then he volunteered, well, I corrected it. And here's the issue. I asked, well, didn't you correct it after talking with your counsel? Perhaps a better way of phrasing it is having an opportunity to talk with your counsel. And at that point, Judge O'Meara, sua sponte, objected in saying that's improper, you have no evidence. My evidence was he volunteered his definition of a strip search on direct examination. He had an opportunity to meet with his counsel, and then he changed his deposition.
You're talking about Mr. Mendez, David?
No, this is Officer Meduzia.
Right, right.
It was
Mendez's strip search claim.
Well, it has to do with Mendez's strip search claim, Montano's strip search claim, Perales, and Ruiz. And I submit, Your Honor, that the exact opposite happened at trial. Look, it was proper questioning of Officer Meduzia about his changed testimony was proper, and it was improper for Judge O'Meara to then object, and improper for O'Meara to then instruct the jury that it's proper for witnesses to change their testimony during depositions. You know, that's something that defense counsel could have, you know, massaged during their cross-examination, but it was no way improper conduct on my part, no way improper conduct on my part meriting the dismissal of the entire case. Another instance of purported misconduct was that during opening argument, I referred to a videotape when the judge had ruled that I wasn't to refer to the videotape.
You referred to it, Mr. Sir,
you're correct,
five
Your Honor.
Times.
Correct, Your Honor, and it was error.
Now, that was
error, Your Honor.
That was not good.
I understand, Your Honor. Yes, I was very tired, and I confused with showing the video with referring to the video, but that was error. However, Your Honor, it was harmless error because Judge O'Meara, the objection to the videotape was a foundation, and there was really no dispute to the foundation. It came in, and there was nothing more said about that incident, Your Honor, and it did not merit the dismissal of the entire case. That incident was of no consequence during the trial. Now, I acknowledge it was improper.
Of course it was of consequence in the trial. It forced the city to respond, and there had been a warning not to mention it. I mean, that is problematic.
Your Honor is correct that there was error made on my part, but with regard to the trial itself and the evidence that came into the trial, the evidence that was going to come into the trial, it did not impact the course of the trial because it was coming in. And Judge O'Meara concluded at the end of the trial, after everything was said and done, that he really had no criticism of what I did. He was a trier of fact, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know that he did. He say I have no on that point, that I have no criticism on that point. I think wasn't he silent on that point and just said, you know, it's permitted in because the horse was out of the barn.
Well, Your Honor, Judge O'Meara stated that no one should criticize you for anything but zealous representations of your client.
Yes, I saw that in the transcript at the very end. It's almost the last thing that Judge O'Meara said.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not disputing that it was error to refer to the videotape in the opening statement, but what I submit, Your Honor, is that the videotape was coming in, and that it did not impact the evidence that was to be introduced at trial. We didn't show the videotape.
You know, speaking of Judge O'Meara, in your brief, you stated that Judge O'Meara forced you to rest your case prematurely before granting the defendant's motion for judgment as a matter of law. And I looked at the transcript. What in your view, did he do that forced you to rest your case prematurely?
He cut the trial down. We had experts who were coming in who could not testify. He also cut the testimony of witnesses on the stand off. For example, there was an independent eyewitness, Josefina Ovalle, who was testifying on the stand that she witnessed an officer, as defendant Lopez, stepping on David Mendez's face. And she was using her hands and making this gesture when he said, "That's enough, that's duplicative testimony, you're off." She was the first one to give that testimony. And that was one, you know, that's one instance where he cut a witness off, and the other instance, and he recessed the case and decided, okay, we're going to conclude this case the next day, and there was no way to get experts in from California and the East Coast. With regard to purported perjury on behalf of the plaintiffs, plaintiff, for example, Esteban Montano, had multiple claims. He has a claim that he was hit in the testicles by Officer Adelano, that he was hit in the back by Officer Adelano, that Officer Adelano hit him, that Officer Tulis hit him in the neck and head, that he was choked by Officer Tulis, that he was punched in a parking lot by Officer Lopez, that he was punched and kicked inside the 10th District Station. They submit that all of Esteban Montano's claims should be dismissed because of reported inconsistency in his testimony about getting hit, for example, on the right side of his head. There's photographs, there's lacerations of him being hit on the left side of his head. At trial, he conceded he wasn't hit on the, may not have been hit on the right side of the head. That is impeachment, or that's inconsistent testimony, but that is not perjury. They also submit that, for example, Ricardo Ruiz did not testify that he saw Esteban Montano punched in the parking lot by Officer Lopez. Montano testified that Officer Lopez punched him in the parking lot, which raised the issue, but they're saying Montano's claim should be dismissed because Ruiz was asked a question at his deposition, well, after what happened on the corner, did you see anything else happen to the plaintiffs until the time you I-bonded out? Well, that's kind of a broad question, which Ruiz did not pick up on at his deposition at that moment, but in another part of his deposition, he said, well, yeah, I saw him, an officer thrust arms at Esteban Montano in the parking lot. It's not perjury because it's not a clear and unambiguous question, a different answer to a clear and ambiguous question. And Montano's claim should not be dismissed because of what defendant Ruiz testified about happened in the parking lot. There are multiple claims.
It's my understanding, counsel, that the jury ultimately did see the video.
Yes, they did.
And does the video depict that a physical altercation, I assume it depicts that a physical altercation between these plaintiffs, your clients, and the various officer defendants occurred. So we're not talking about whether it happened or didn't happen, but it's just its scope, its magnitude, the intent of the officers, and the objective reasonableness of their actions, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but what they're suggesting is that because there are some inconsistencies in plaintiff's testimony in this chaotic event, which took place in various areas on a street corner, on a parking lot, inside a police station, that the entire case should be dismissed.
But aren't you minimizing the inconsistencies here? And weren't the responses about why testimony was changed by various of the plaintiffs that they suddenly remembered because they had dreams or they had flashbacks or or that they all met and discussed it, you know, the testimony?
Well,
isolated little points are one thing, but we have to look at a global picture here.
Your Honor, what Your Honor is referencing is really specific to Julio Perales and his recollection or his testimony about being strip searched. It doesn't have to do with what Esteban Montano said or Carlo Reed said or David Mendez said necessarily. It really has to do with Julio Perales and his strip search claim.
But some of the plaintiffs seem to have forgotten whether they or their friends were beaten up or how severely they were beaten up or if they were strip searched at all.
How do you respond
to that?
Esteban Montano stated at his deposition that he was punched by Officer Lopez inside the 10th District Station, and there was some blood on his nose. That was his testimony. David Mendez testified that he didn't notice blood on Esteban Montano's face after he came back. He was not clear about that. That is an inconsistent testimony of one witness that does not justify the dismissal of the primary plaintiff's claim, that is of Esteban Montano. That goes to credibility, Your Honor. That's not perjury. It goes to credibility. With regard to Esteban, going back to Julio Perales and his changed testimony, it's, you know, the course of human nature. You've experienced a very traumatic event. You give a deposition 2 years after the event. You go to trial 2 more years after the event. 4 years after the event, there you are. You're in a room. You're talking about the event, and you might recollect, and you're thinking about this. It's rolling around your mind. You may recollect things you were not able to recollect at the time of your deposition. The other instances have to do with regard, for example, identification of witness of defendants. Plaintiffs were provided with blurry black and white photographs. If they're able to see a defendant on the stand, they might be able, it's not inconsistent or unreasonable, that they might be able to identify the defendant when they see him.
I want to take you to a different area, if I might, because the district court concluded that you failed to identify a policymaker who knew about the record of complaints against Lopez prior to September of 1997. Did you identify any policymaker who knew about Lopez's history, or is your argument solely that the failure to implement an early warning system was an unconstitutional city policy that allowed this officer Lopez to slip through the cracks?
It's the latter on that particular argument, Your Honor. If you want to jump to the Monell issue, Your Honor, we submit that we have a very good Monell claim with regard to the decision of a policymaker, the police board, with regard to the Jorge Guillen case. In the Jorge Guillen case, Jorge Guillen, the OPS investigator, a department advocate, and the superintendent found that after Jorge Higuin, who was psychotic at the time, after he was subdued, face down, and shackled with someone, with police officer on his back and or neck, a police officer hit him in the back of the head with a large metal flashlight, mag flashlight. Those were the findings of fact by the, ultimately by the superintendent who imposed a suspension for the officer who did it and the officer who failed to intervene in the hitting the head with the flashlight. That was the only issue before the police board. The police board vacated that finding, stating that there was no, because there was no damage to his skull or brain, didn't cause injury, so no suspension.
You are into your rebuttal time.
All right.
But I do want to ask you this. What's the status of your state law claims? Did Judge Duryigin implement our previous opinion directing the district court to exercise supplemental jurisdiction?
Yes, he reinstated them and then dismissed them all pursuant to his order on sanctions.
Now, if your case were to be remanded, would you seek to try the state law claims with any remaining federal claims, or do you not?
Yes, we'd have to because of the David Mendez case, not pulling down the underwear. That may not technically be a Section 1983 violation because he said he didn't pull down his underwear, didn't comply with the unlawful order, but it would still be a state law claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Thanks. Okay. Mr. Enriquez.
May it please the court, in this case, five plaintiffs brought suit against more than 30 police officers and the city of Chicago. Ultimately, none of the claims succeeded. Summary judgment was entered on some claims. Directed verdicts were entered on other claims, and the remaining claims were dismissed as sanctions for coordinated perjury by plaintiffs and misconduct by their attorney. This morning, I will explain that all the summary judgment rulings were correct, that plaintiffs' challenges to the directed verdicts entered on two of the claims were waived on appeal, and that the sanctions order was not only proper as to all the claims it dismissed, but it is an alternative ground for affirming the judgments on the claims that were erroneously directed out.
Before you begin, I would like to know what evidence there is in the record that Yesenia Mendez committed perjury or participated in a coordinated effort by the plaintiffs to present a false version of the events. Because I didn't see any mention of her by Judge Duryigin. Now, I could have missed that.
You're correct. Your Honor, you're correct. There is no evidence, and in fact, in our brief, we explain, we acknowledge that there was no evidence that she committed any perjury at the trial. We do say, though, that she stood to benefit from the perjury that was established with respect to the four males, and she did not disassociate herself from that perjury.
All right. Now, how? I know that because I know it's your footnote 15. But what should she have done to disassociate herself?
Well, for
get
start-
up in court and say all of the other plaintiffs are liars. What could she have done?
Given that there was also attorney misconduct problems in the case, she should have gotten another attorney who could have asked to have her claim severed from those because of the perjury and attorney misconduct that had been going on in the case already. Or she could have approached the judge herself privately.
And she's supposed to, I mean, if indeed there was, she's supposed to know this? She's supposed to know that all of these
It was apparent at the trial that there were inconsistencies between the deposition testimony and testimony at trial. She saw that. There should have been no question in anybody's mind who was sitting in that courtroom that this rampant inconsistencies between trial testimony and deposition testimony was occurring, and she was allowing herself to be part of that. She should have dissociated herself from that in in the ways that I've mentioned. If I may return to the summary judgment motions for just a second, with respect to the summary judgment claims against the officers and the Monell claim against the city, plaintiffs failed to adduce crucial evidence to support each of their claims. We describe at length in our brief which plaintiffs, which claims, and exactly what evidence. And we will rest on that submission for all claims against the officers. There's no rejoinder to that, obviously, since no reply brief was filed in this case.
Yeah.
We also explain in our brief that on the Section 1983 claims of Ruiz, Perales, and David Mendez for false arrest against officers Atilano and LaFrancis, qualified immunity was one of two independent grounds on which the district court entered summary judgment in favor of the officers, that plaintiffs have waived any challenge to that ruling by failing to present such a challenge in their brief, and that in any event, the district court correctly concluded that the officers were entitled to qualified immunity.
Could we talk about Officer Lopez for a moment? Because you suggested in your brief that the city has an elaborate system to ensure that problem officers are removed from the force. Yet Lopez was ultimately fired for breaking a man's jaw in an incident that happened 3 weeks before the incident in this case. Now, isn't the fact that Officer Lopez was not suspended during the investigation of that complaint, which was the 13th one against him in a three-week period, enough to show that the city had an inadequate policy for handling complaints? I mean, if he had been suspended or otherwise reassigned after the jawbreaking incident, he would not have been on the streets on the night in question. And why doesn't that show causation here?
Well, first of all, let me correct Your Honor, if I may. That was the 13th complaint register charge against him in his career, in his four-and-a-half-year career.
Thank you.
Until July 5th of 1997, which is, until July 5th, 1997, which is several weeks before the incident in this case, he had had, I think, 9 complaints against him. None of the one was sustained, but it wasn't for excessive force. The other 8 were for excessive force. They were not sustained. It then happened that within the period between July 5th and the independence celebration on September the 14th, 4 more charges came in, all for excessive force. Based on his history at the time, of course, all of the charges against him, all the allegations in the previous complaints had been, none of them had been found well-founded. So when others come in, there's no reason at that point to believe that the current ones would be founded as well, and so therefore no reason to take him off the street. And he wasn't. As it turned out, after these were under investigation at the time of the independence celebration on September 14th, and afterwards one of them, actually 2 were sustained, and one of them resulted in his firing. But it's sort of Monday morning quarterbacking to look back and say, if only he'd been taken off the street, this wouldn't have happened. And certainly that kind of Monday morning quarterbacking is not the standard that the city has to meet in order to preclude or foreclose a Monell claim. The standard is deliberate indifference, and there's no indication that faced with any officer's situation that there was a deliberate indifference here. In order for there to have been deliberate indifference here, there almost certainly would have had to have been evidence of a widespread practice showing that officers who were under investigation for claims of excessive force have a higher incidence or a much higher incidence of using excessive force later on than officers who were not. There was no reason to take him off the street based on the evidence presented in this case. There's no reason to take him off the street any more than there was to take any officer off the street, including officers who have no allegations against them.
Is the videotape in the record?
The videotape is in the record.
And if we were to watch it, what would it show?
First of all, the videotape is only for a very there are actually various aspects of the video. It shows some activity on the street, including some of the plaintiffs out in the middle of the street. It also shows a very short clip of the five persons who were given a pat-down search on the car. And it shows a fracas between Officer Adelano and I guess, I don't know the name, the people, but from the evidence in the record, it would seem to include the fracas with Montano. It's very quick, very brief, only a few seconds. It's hard to gauge what goes on, and it's we certainly invite the court to see it. There's nothing that we think it helps.
Was there any good argument for keeping that out?
Potential confusion of it stops and starts. It doesn't show everything, and it certainly doesn't show any of the claims that occurred with respect to any of the other arrestees after this little fracas with Officer Adelano. It doesn't show anything at the police stations. It doesn't show.
What difference does that make to admissibility? Seems to me it's a critical piece of evidence.
Well, we welcome the court to take a look at it. You can decide. I think it was probably a close call about whether or not it should come in. But we actually made the decision that, on balance, it wasn't something that we thought should come into evidence. The judge had not decided whether he would let it come into evidence prior to the trial.
Why did he defer ruling?
His reasons were that it depended on certain evidence that he wanted to come in as a predicate to it. He described that evidence. I can't remember the details of what evidence he said it depended upon. But he was unmistakably clear that neither side could refer to it during opening statements. And, of course, plaintiff's counsel did five times.
I understand that there was contempt committed here because there was a direct order and it was violated multiple times, as Judge Rovner has pointed out. But the point of my questions and my questions to your counterpart for the plaintiffs is that the video apparently depicts a physical altercation, a violent altercation between the people who were being frisked and the police. So there isn't a question that an incident occurred. The question in the trial is, what was the scope of that incident? Who did what to whom, when? But we're not talking about an issue about an incident that either did occur or didn't occur. It did occur, and it's depicted on the videotape. And so the discrepancies that we have in the testimony of the plaintiffs from deposition to trial and the changed testimony doesn't pertain to whether the incident occurred or not. It pertains to its scope. And customarily, those sorts of discrepancies and changed testimony and new details supplied at trial that weren't supplied at deposition are ordinarily matters for impeachment and for a jury to work out and don't supply the basis for a perjury finding and a sanction of dismissal of the entire case.
Yes, if my memory is correct, the incident depicted on the video has nothing to do with any of the incidents that we rely on and that Judge Duryagin relied on in ruling in entering the sanctions order. Those were pertinent, of course, to the trial and to some of the claims on which directed verdicts were entered. But Judge Duryagin did not rely on anything that happened at that pat-down search as a basis for his ruling. The seven or eight other incidents were ones that Judge Duryagin relied on. And in every instance, a particular plaintiff testified at trial in a way that supported his claim or the claim of one of his co-plaintiffs after having testified given on that same matter at his deposition the opposite way in ways that undermined his claim.
That happens all the time.
not this way, and for several different reasons.
What was qualitatively different about this?
What's different about this is the sheer number of incidents, the fact that it's all a one-way street. This was always testimony and depositions that were contrary to the claim, followed by testimony at trial that supported the claim. In ways that themselves, the sheer number of those, would suggest that after the depositions and before the trial, the plaintiffs made a concerted effort to decide what they were going to say. I mean, some of these were plaintiff testifying on his own claim. Some of them were plaintiffs testifying on the claim of his co-plaintiff to support those claims. But they all went the same way. And in fact, that alone would show coordination, as Judge Duryagin found. But in addition to that, there was testimony that the plaintiffs got together more than 10 times to discuss this, and Judge Duryagin relied on that as well. And so we believe that the finding of perjury in this case, coordinated perjury in this case, is a finding that any reasonable fact finder would find. In fact, it's the only finding based on the evidence in this case that any reasonable fact finder would find. And I want to remind the court also that these aren't just incidents of a trivial nature. These are incidents that no one would forget. Whether Officer Adelano hit Montano in the head with a flashlight, he testified that Officer Adelano did not even try to hit him in the head with a flashlight, and then at trial said that it happened. That's something that no one would forget. Whether or not you see your friend, your co-plaintiff, being stomped on by police officers in your presence, you say at the deposition it didn't happen, and then you say at trial it did, that's something no one would forget. And it's not the excuses of flashbacks and dreams just are as problematic as the inconsistencies themselves. This was an extraordinary case. We acknowledge that the sanctions order was an extraordinary order, but it was justified because the nature of the perjury and of the attorney misconduct in this case was so extraordinary as well.
I want to just ask you something about that videotape, and it's this. After it became clear to the city during opening statements that plaintiff's counsel wasn't following the court's order not to mention the videotape, why didn't counsel for the city object to the repeated references to the tape?
Well, actually, we were prejudiced by not only the references to it, but by the substance of those references. Counsel for plaintiffs.
You mean if the judge lets us?
If the judge lets us, that obviously told the jury that the plaintiffs wanted it in and the defendants didn't want it out. We couldn't unring that bell.
Why didn't you object and ask for a mistrial?
Well, we like the jury. We didn't want to have to forego that. And, of course, the sanctions, the law concerning sanctions, didn't require us to do that. The judge can enter different sanctions. There's no reason why why we should have to throw out this jury and start the case over at great expense because of the plaintiff did this. Plaintiffs sometimes commit such misconduct in order to, because they don't like the jury, and there's no reason why.
Why didn't you move for sanctions at that time? Wasn't that a good time to move for a sanction?
It may have been, but nothing precluded us from moving for sanctions later on. It didn't have to occur at that moment, and we ultimately did move for sanctions. With respect to the directed verdicts, we do explain in our brief that plaintiffs have waived challenges to the directed verdicts entered on two of the claims. The details of those waivers are in our brief, and we rest on that submission. As to the rest of the claims on which the district court directed verdicts, those rulings were flawed. But we also explain in our brief that the sanctions order provides an alternative basis for affirming the judgments in favor of the officers on claims on which the district court entered erroneous verdicts.
The alternative basis being the sanctions?
The alternative basis being the sanctions.
Okay. That was a sua sponte order, as I understand it, by Judge O'Meara? A sua sponte directed verdict?
Well, it was actually Judge O'Meara, as plaintiff's brief says, invited the motion for directed verdicts by our counsel. And after a very long argument concerning it, which is set forth in the appendix to the plaintiff's brief, where both sides presented all their arguments, our counsel ended up saying that although we're presenting this motion, perhaps it would be better for you to let us go ahead and put on our case in chief. The judge did not require that. He ended up entering the directed verdicts in the case. Now, of course, the sanctions order covered only the claims that were pending at the time it was entered. And those were the state law claims and the two federal claims on which the mistrial had been declared. But we say it is a good alternative ground for affirmance in this case. We ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment.
Mr. Henriquez. Mr. Cerda, how much time does Mr. Cerda have?
With regard to the video, the issue for its admission was foundation. That's stated in the record. With regard to the video is much more substantive than it was just characterized by defendant's counsel. The video shows five persons on the car. Esteban Montano's in the center of the car. You see some motion from Officer Adelano in between Esteban Montano's legs. It's claimed by Esteban Montano that Officer Adelano flicked his wrist and hit him in the testicles because Officer Adelano believed that Montano called his partner a white whore in Spanish. The video also shows that after getting hit in the testicles, Esteban Montano turned and said, you know, what did you hurt me? Words to that effect. And the video shows, and you can hear Officer Adelano then taking a large metal flashlight and whacking Esteban Montano across the back, calling him a motherfucker. The video then shows Officer Montano putting his hands up like this and Officer Adelano attempting to hit him in the head. The video also shows then Officer Tulis responding and actually hitting Esteban Montano in the neck full force with the large metal flashlight. There's a freeze frame. If you stop it, you'll see the strobe, and you'll see that happening. There's also evidence of photographs that Esteban Montano was hit in the head. The purported inconsistency in Esteban Montano's testimony about being hit in the head by Adelano was that he was hit by Adelano, he was hit by Tulis in the head, but at trial he said, well, maybe Adelano didn't actually make contact with my head, but he testified that Adelano hit him in the testicles, Adelano hit him in the back, that Adelano failed to intervene when Officer Tulis, who can be seen on the video, was choking Esteban Montano like this, and he was losing breath. Now there's another inconsistency where they say Officer Montano's claim should be dismissed, because when Esteban Montano is being choked, being lifted off his feet by Officer Tulis, Officer Kuzar, another officer, comes in and tries to take a flashlight and appears to try to jam it underneath his neck. And Montano throws his arm out. And there's a dispute, well, did he punch him? Did he make contact with him? It's a semantic difference. He was justified in hitting him, whether he didn't admit in his deposition that he punched him and then admitted at trial under a cross-examination that he threw a punch. If there's a video, you can judge it for yourself. But that's not perjury. That's for has to do with credibility, and in this court, Allen has ruled that issues of credibility should be decided by the trier of fact, even when there is perjury, ordinarily. With regard to the purported inconsistencies in testimony, we really invite the court. They've been here and in the briefs have been mischaracterized by this global patterning of the many, many instances. You have to look at each one. We've practically discussed them all here at trial, and they have to do with small points in the whole process. For example, going back to Ruiz. Ruiz was asked at a deposition about, this interaction happened at the squad car. Did you see anything else happen? He answered no. Well, if this is a search for the truth, the paragraph 32nd of our complaint, Montano was punched by an unknown officer when he came out of the squad role. Defendant's counsel, Sampson, could have asked him, Ruiz, what do you know about this? Do you know anything about this? He didn't ask him about that. He asked him about what happened at the corner and then gave him a broad question, what happened here, and he didn't mention the punching outside the squad role, but elsewhere in his deposition he did mention it. And so that's not impeachment because it has to be a different answer to a clear and unambiguous question. With regard to the Monell claim, there were actually four complaints, violent complaints against Officer Lopez in the weeks preceding this incident. Three were actually sustained initially. They vacated the other one, which involves Zalewski. But there should have been in place at that time when you have a pattern of four violent complaints against one officer, there should have been a system in place at that time to take that officer off the street. Submission by defendant's expert, who is a former superintendent, is that he would have taken Officer Lopez off the street. And the city's failure to have an early warning system is a constitutional violation because, but for that, Officer Lopez would not have been on the street at that time. I'm just flipping through the brief because going back to the sanctions issue, I think we discussed in open court the inconsistencies. And by the way, it wasn't a one-way street. With regard to changed testimony at a trial, David Mendez acknowledged that he didn't pull his pants down. So he changed, he gave testimony at trial, which foreclosed his Section 1983 claim. With regard to the videotape, it would have been error not to have admitted the videotape into evidence. It was substantive evidence, should have been there. Whether there was contempt and there should have been a fine, that may have been for the trial court to decide, but the sanction for that was not dismissal of the entire case. And if you really want to look at an instance of perjury, there was perjury committed by the defendants in this case. The city did like the jury in that case, but I was going to win anyway. I never got to make the closing argument. If you look at the videotape, there's a time stamp on it during this altercation. It's 8:08:08. That's the time of night. And then the next time stamp on it is 8:09:09. There's 61 seconds of time. The video runs for, in real time, 41 seconds. There are cuts that are missing. So you know that there are only 20 seconds missing in video from that scene. There are only 20 seconds missing, and there's testimony that the most time missed out of that video in one section was 6 seconds. They were mostly 2-second, 3-second bites. So you put this video together, and there are only 20 seconds missing. During that time, Officers Arellano, Tools, LaFrancis, and Kuzar said a group of 20 persons jumped them and interfered with the arrest of Esteban Montano. Well, look at the video, including Ruiz and Perales, who were on the car, and the other two were on the car. They're still on the car. They didn't move. They didn't jump anybody. They made it up and they got caught in a big lie. And we submit that this case should be remanded, that if anyone committed perjury in this case, it was the defendants who committed perjury in this case. You can review the video, and that's what you'll see. With regard to one other point here. With regard to Yesenia Mendez's claim against Officer Meduzia. How much time?
You're okay.
With regard to her claim against Officer Meduzia, Officer Meduzia stated for the reasons for her arrest because she had a smart mouth, she should go back to Mexico, what are you talking about? He did not have justification for arresting her. She was not causing a crowd to gather. The crowd was dispersing. And that a citizen should have a right to ask an officer after they've beaten up her husband, dragged him down the street, ask him why he did this. For asking why you did that to my husband, she was arrested for disorderly conduct, and we submit that was improper.
Let me just ask you something. I took a look at the docket, and did you never have even a status before Judge Duryigian? Was it all done on the papers here?
There was no evidentiary hearing with regard to
that. No, I know that. But did you ever have did you ever go in at all?
We did, but really what was done at that time is the city said it was going to file some motions.
Okay, so you did appear.
Yes.
Huh. Okay.
I wonder why I haven't looked at it, but we did appear.
I'll look at it again. Well, all right, everyone. Thank you so much, Mr. Cerda,
Your Honor.
Mr. Enriquez. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement.